For the final talk for this morning, we have JJ Carrasco, who's going to tell us about a nice approach to scattering in non-planar theories.
I was saying what a pleasure it is to be here. So it's a pleasure to be here. This has been a fantastic conference. All right, so if I was still from America, I would give something very exciting and very bold, right? But now that I'm European, I'm going to be very solid and concrete and no hyperbole. All right, so let's leap into it. So we see we've got two graphs at 5.1 loop if there are no triangles and no bubbles. I've neglected to write down all the external permutations of the legs because that makes it look nicer. at two loop, now we've got six, and at three loop, now we've got a bunch. Right, and it only gets worse from there. And so what motivates what I'm going after here is that we face this factorial increase in complexity as we go to higher multiplicity, as we go to higher loops, and we'd like something that could help fight this at least a little bit as we go higher and higher. And so I've just drawn a couple curves here, the curve that we don't even notice. This blue curve, m squared, this is if you had some n-body classical interaction, you're just writing down all the interaction terms, you'd have something that scales as m squared, and we don't even care about that. Right above that, I have something that's scaling exponentially. This is a Catalan number, so this is associated with the number of graphs you write down for a planar amplitude, for a color-ordered amplitude. So this is scales... This is e to the m, so they're like a Catalan number. The gold. Then the green is the number of cubic graphs you expect in full non-planar theories at tree level. And it serves as a good proxy for what you expect to see as you go to higher loop orders. And then the n minus 3 factorial squared is what you get out of the most compact sort of KLT expression as you look to try to write down gravity tree level amplitudes, and you'll notice that that the scale just goes crazy very 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 quickly, and so this is what we'd like to address. And one of the things that got me so excited about coloring kinematics dancing together is that this sets up a very nice interplay between graphs that starts rigidly locking down graphs. The contributions of graphs to the entire scattering amplitude, such that in many cases we find you only need a small bit of information and it propagates to everything. And the idea is that you can... So what I've written here is a representation of a Jacobi relation, where you can think of this as a color factor, if you like. A color factor of this graph is going to be the color factor of this graph and the color factor plus the color factor of this graph. But it turns out for our favorite gauge theories, and from pure Yang-Mills through n equals 4 super Yang-Mills, and a beautiful paper recently on QCD with massive fermions in the fundamental, that we're able to find representations where our kinematics are obeying the same algebraic relations as our color factors. And as Donal emphasized so beautifully in his last talk, when you find this funny gauge where kinematics and color are dancing together, then you get gravity amplitudes for free. Okay. And so I'm going to use this as an opportunity to introduce Jacobi moves, or what I call Jacobi moves, which is to take an edge of an operator and just rework it. And so a T hat would take this S type diagram and rework it to this diagram, and a U hat would take this and just rework it to here. And with this, you can write down color kinematics in terms of operators around edges. But this also, you can also think of this entire thing as a representation of the four-point tree level amplitude. So if I dress each vertex with the numerator, the color factor, and the denominator, then my four-point tree level gauge theory amplitude is just going to be the sum of each vertex weight. Okay, and so as I said, having Jacobi relations between all the graphs rigidly locks the kinematic contributions to dance with each other, and it gets even more powerful in theories with less and less topologies. Like the more symmetry you have, the less like triangle subdiagrams or bubble subdiagrams you'll have. And so for three loops, all the kinematic information is encoded in this one guy, and Jacobi relations, linear relations, propagate this out so that everybody else is encoded in the kinematic factor of that one graph, associated with that one graph. And I should say, wait, before I move on, is that once it's in this representation, you have at the integrand level the scattering amplitude of associated gravity theories. And so if by replacing the color factors with another copy of kinematic weights, and if the kinematic weights come from different theories, then you build up different gravity theories. Okay, so at 5.3 loop n equals 4, only this one non-planar guy is required to encode all the information for everybody else. At 4 loops, only this one non-planar guy is required to encapsulate all the information for everybody else. And so there's the hint that this may be the type of thing that that can propagate, that can start bringing some of this factorial explosion under control if we can find a way of writing our S-matrix calculations to capitalize on this. And what you discover is that instead of having to stare at this sea of graphs, you only have to pay attention to one, right? And you learn things from this representation. One of the things we learned from this for loop calculation in this form is that there exists integral relations between gauge and gravity theories, not just integrand relations. Okay, so is the problem solved? Are we done? No, we want all order understanding, and there's something very significant that blocks us, a very frustrating problem. And that's to exploit color kinematics at loop level means solving functional equations. That sure, we're controlling the number of master graphs. It's not spiraling out of control. As I said, through four loops, I only needed one. But now I need an ansatz to actually impose the Jacobi relations. And it's because, as you can see here, Jacobiing around this edge, I see this topology contributing with a certain labeling and then appearing again with a different labeling. Right? So it's the same topology appearing with two different labelings. At tree level, this isn't a problem at all. So this is, remember I showed you 4 point as a triangle. This is what 5 point looks like, where every vertex is a graph and every edge is a Jacobi move connecting the graphs. And so at 5 point, you've got two internal vertices and so you have two triangles associated with every vertex, and each triangle represents a Jacobi identity between graphs. Okay, so you can think of this as something that you'd be very familiar with, like with color factors, but it turns out you can come up with kinematic weights that handle this too. Now, at tree level, as I said, there's no problem. Each of these graphs, each of these vertices is a distinct graph, right? And so I can just find some boundary set of graphs that through these triangles determine everybody else. And I never run into any conflict. It's just simply solving linear relations. Okay? But at loop level, as I said, there are functional constraints. And this is what goes under the name of the label shifting problem. Now this is the same graph as this, but with a different label, a different permutation. This is the same graph as this, but with a different label. And so these triangles relating things are placing functional constraints on some function that I want to satisfy this. And the only way we know how to satisfy these functional constraints is by imposing an ansatz. Okay, so let's get specific. Why do we care? Well, one reason we care about looking at higher loops is because we'd like to understand the origins of divergences in quantum field theories of gravity. Evidently, they're intimately related to anomalies, some of which, at least, can be appreciated as double copies of anomalies in non-supersymmetric Yang-Mills. And we should be hearing more on this from Tristan's talk. But the question that has me by the tail is the maximally supersymmetric supergravity theory perturbatively finite? I mentioned we have integral relations that we discovered in the for-loop calculation. What you see is that the soup, so this is a gravity divergence in the critical dimension at for loops. And you see the integrals that appear in the gravity divergence are exactly the integrals that appear in the subleading color contribution, the subleading, so down by this, the subleading color contribution of the gauge theory. And this is exactly the same integrals in exactly the same proportion. Now, if this held to all loop order, then, of course, n equals 8 would be perturbatively finite to all loop order. And we've done five loops. We know what the integrals are at subleading color at five loops in Yang-Mills, but we don't know what the supergravity answer is. And why don't we know what the supergravity answer is? It's because five loops is huge. Right, so for five loops, n equals 4 super Yang-Mills, and we're trying to find a color kinematic solution, around 900 cubic graphs with no bubbles and no triangles, Jacobi's fit to a set of two non-planar masters. You can impose a consistent minimal power counting. You can impose all the symmetries. But the moment you try to fit it to the data, the moment you try to say, I'm talking about n equals 4 super Yang-Mills, with this minimal ansatz, it breaks immediately. And this is just like three loops. There's a reason it took 2 years to go from planar color kinematics tree-level color kinematics to loop-level color kinematics. And it's because when we're looking at three loops, we're missing these graphs, right? And so we could impose all the Jacobis, but we couldn't fit to the theory. The theory wanted these graphs to show up. Okay, so for five loops, how could we relax our ansatz? We could relax the power counting. We could allow more loop momentum than the minimal. We could allow for additional graphs, like non-planar triangles. We could generalize our prescription to handle unusual graphs, like maybe these guys are important to five loops. Perhaps we need non-local numerators, but once you start saying, oh, maybe I'll have numerators that are non-local loop momenta, you've completely blown open the bounds of the complexity of trying to actually solve this problem, right? Because there's no controlled way of exploring all non-local loop momenta. Okay, so you can ask, is there a non-ansatz path forward? And I'm here to tell you there is. There is a non-ansatz path forward, and that's what I'd like to describe. Okay, it's a solution to this label-shifting problem. And the solution, in some sense, is very simple. You introduce a distinct graph for every possible labeling of the endpoint L-loop graph topologies. So this will be isomorphic to a subset of 2L plus M point tree graphs with 2L external labels labeled with the internal off-shell loop momenta tracking for your loop level integrand. So you allow each of these different permutations of labels to actually be their own graph. Okay, so brief interlude, a comment on my title. I said a nice approach. So I guess typically nice is used to be pleasing, agreeable, delightful. I meant it actually in this very specific way of being characterized by great precision or delicacy. We are going to be labeling every single way momentum can flow through these multi-loop graphs. And that's a lot. There's a caution, which is the origin of the word nice evidently comes from the Middle English foolish or stupid, the old friend silly. And there will be a lot of graphs. And so this is just something to be careful with. All right. So this is algebraic loop level approach. I'm going to introduce multi-loop objects, which I call pre-integrands. They're going to contain all cut information manifestly, not functionally. You can decompose these guys into color-stripped polytopes just like at tree level. Introduce enough graphs to cover all labelings. And each graph appears with fixed labels so you can solve Jacobi's linearly. Just like a tree level. Okay, so just to contrast with the way we normally write our integrands, which is functional. When we say we have a functional integrand, it means we have a set of mappings from graphs to numerators, denominators, color factors, and symmetry factors. And having this functional mapping where you have a graph with different labels gets mapped to kinematic factors with different labels or denominators, with different labels or color factors, with different labels, makes it very easy to verify on unitarity cuts. I'm not going to talk about verification on unitarity cuts today, but there are a lot of advantages to these functional integrands. And because it's easy to verify on unitarity cuts, it's easy to verify that you actually have the answer, that you're not missing anything when you're done constructing your integrand. And cut satisfaction means that your amplitude at the end of the day, when you have this mapping, is given by, you know, an integral over a simple function of permutations of graphs. Two integrands that satisfy all cuts must differ by at most something that integrates to zero. So once you've satisfied all the cuts, you have an answer. Now, in contrast, these pre-integrands, we're gonna build with off-shell data from functional integrands, but they're not the answer. If you integrated the object I'm going to tell you, then you wouldn't land on the answer for the theory because the combinatorics would be wrong. But there's a way of backing out from the pre-integrand to a functional integrand that lets you then integrate. What's the path to building these pre-integrands? You take your 2L plus M point color dress tree graphs. You identify the 2L external legs with a plus or minus independent loop momenta labels, and then you sum over your color mapping, your numerator factor over your denominator of all these graphs. And as I said, you can consider the color stripped decomposition of these objects. So just to set the stage, I'm going to review some of what the structure is like at tree level. So graphs contribute. So almost everybody here, no matter whether you do planar n equals 4 or non-planar, you know, QCD, appreciates the power of color-stripped, color-ordered tree-level amplitudes. And it turns out that graphs contributing to color-ordered tree-level amplitudes generate the one skeleton of Stashev polytopes, where these graphs are joined only by T-hat operations. So you start with one guy in a color order, you operate with a T-hat operator bringing you to another graph, right? But it maintains exactly the same color order. T-hat to another graph to another graph. So at 5 points, the polytope, or the one skeleton's a pentagon. These guys are also called isosahedra. And the important thing is that this T-hat operation maintains color order. You might think that you need n minus 2 factorial of these color order amplitudes to capture everything, because that's what's required to touch every vertex contributing to the entire amplitude once, right? And so if you look at the different colors, you'll see this is one pentagon mapped out here, and this edge overlaps with the orange pentagon that maps out these guys, and so on and so forth. So you need n minus 2 factorial of these guys to touch every graph at least once. In fact, this is the Kleist-Coif basis, proven by Del Duca, Dixon, and Altoni to be sufficient to cover all the information of full color tressed tree level amplitudes. But notice, because of the ability to satisfy Jacobi relations, only n minus 2 factorial nodes, these boundary guys, are needed to specify entirely all the data on the interior of this structure. So you only need these graphs, the graphs represented by these nodes, and Jacobi push data in through triangles to internal guys, right? And so this outer boundary completely specifies the data of the theory, right? This outer set of vertices. Turns out this reduces the set of necessary color-ordered amplitudes to n minus 3 factorial, because you only need n minus 3 factorial color-ordered amplitudes, these two pentagons, for example, to touch all six of these nodes. At every multiplicity, the masters, these graphs, the guys who through Jacobi determined the color factors, the numerator factors of everybody else, can be chosen from the one skeleton of a polytope related by the U-hat operation on every internal edge of the scattering graphs. So I've labeled the nodes here just because I didn't want to draw this diagram a bunch of times. So X, Y, Z is represented by the labels of each of these vertex, and you see you go from here to here by just permuting 1 and 2. So U-hat operation on 1 and 2 here, you go from here to there by permuting the 3 and 1, and so on and so forth. These polytopes are called permutahedra. Okay. So you can linearly solve for the n minus 2 factorial numerators of the masters in terms of the n minus 3 factorial independent color-ordered amplitudes, right? So you can solve for these guys in terms of this. In fact, you get these guys in terms of, you get n minus 3 factorial of these guys. In this case, you get two of these guys in terms of this, and then the rest of them are free. So these guys will depend on the rest, right? But they're free functions. It's a generalized gauge freedom. And what's this? So this is after you've imposed Jacobi on both numerators and color factors. You haven't completely specified the functional form of your numerators. So you could in fact choose these guys to be vanishing if you want, so that you only needed n minus 3 factorial numerators at every multiplicity. Building blocks at 6 points, the sociohedron associated with every color ordered amplitude takes on this geometry. The set of masters, the permutahedron, takes on this topology. So this is just the set of masters on the external edges. So just this, there's 105 graphs, and they arrange themselves inside this boundary of masters that through Jacobi specify them. This set of masters is fixed by 6 color ordered partial amplitudes. Okay, and here we're permuting around, remember it's a U-hat operation going to all of them, and we're permuting around 4 unspecified labels. So all permutations of 1 through 4, right, for all these vertices. Now we can talk interestingly about the pre-integrands of loops. So this is now the same set of masters, but what I'm going to do is I'm going to cross out what was my external leg 6, and I'll replace it with an internal off-shell label L. I'll cross out 5, and I'll replace it with internal off-shell label minus L, and that gives me the specific labeling that targets this one particular graph with loop momentum going from W to Z. And this set of masters takes all permutations of the box. With the loop momentum, you'll notice going both ways as X, W swap with Y and Z. Of course, you have contributions of non-masters, especially for theories with less supersymmetry. So you'll have triangles and bubbles and so forth. But again, it just comes, you're labeling it by taking this set of 2L plus M multiplicity trees and associating the 2L external labels to target your internal momenta. You capture every way the momentum can flow through every diagram. So any given associohedra will be, so the color stripped pre-integrand will be composed of all the one loop graphs labeled appropriately to the color order. So you have this guy, and then you have the t-hat operation mapping him to this guy, and so on and so forth. following out exactly this this geometry. You can dress this with known off-shell information using unitarity recursion. Whatever tools you like to actually start dressing these guys with the boundary data. And this boundary data doesn't need to come from a Jacobi satisfying representation. You can get this from any representation. Right, just like nobody, you know, once you have this gauge invariant object at tree level, color strip amplitude, it doesn't matter what it came from, right? It's just an object. This will be boundary data that lets you find Jacobi satisfying representations. You demand that these guys on this external boundary satisfy Jacobis, propagate them inside, and then solve for the new boundary data in terms of these guys who are dressed with off-shell data. And this works. For n equals 4, supering mills at 4.1 loop, you only need boxes, so in fact, all these relations are just identities. So these all, I mean, so because there are no triangles, they're just two-term identities, so each of these functions is in fact the same thing, and Jacobi equations reduce all numerators to the same function, STA tree. This should be a familiar result. For maximally supersymmetric Yang mills at 4.2 loop, you only need planar and non-planar boxes. Jacobi relations reduce all numerators to a linear combination of two of these objects, one that's dressed with S by STA tree and one that's dressed by T, STA tree. Because every other contribution of permutations of labels is represented by a linear superposition of these. And I should say that in one sense this would be trivial if I just you could say this is trivial if I just dressed these guys with the known Jacobi satisfying representation. In fact, you can dress these guys with representations that don't. So you can dress your boundary data with representations that manifestly violate Jacobi, like the integrand representation associated with the D-log form that Zvi and collaborators found recently. But still, through this operation, you can shake out the noise that doesn't satisfy Jacobi and land on this representation. Whoa. Let's see. Where was I? Yeah. Okay. Good. Now, after you've imposed Jacobi, you have a color kinematic satisfying representation at loop level without introducing any ansatz. But these asymmetric graphs can have Jacobis imposed linearly on all edges but L, right? So there will be privileged labels associated with each of these graphs that you won't be able to Jacobi around because it's ambiguous. It's an ambiguous operation. The conjecture, and this is what I've seen so far through a lower supersymmetry at one loop and n equals 4 or 5 points at one loop and two loop is that this is sufficient for double copy to hold. But to verify, to know that you actually have this scattering amplitude, you should verify your gravity amplitude on a spanning set of cuts after symmetrizing to a functional representation. At least this is the only way I know right now how to check to make sure that you've actually landed on the correct gravity amplitude, is that you should check it on a spanning set of cuts, because this idea that it's sufficient for double copy to hold to have all but L edges satisfy Jacobis is very much a conjecture. As I said, it's been verified at one loop for n less than 4, verified two loops for maximally supersymmetric. Okay, so I'm going to close the summary. I presented a path forward to a color kinematic satisfying representation without an ansatz. There's a cautionary note, however, that this description increases the redundancy of the graph description, not quite to depending upon the theory you're applying it to, it approaches the maximal redundancy suggested by the forward limit of tree level amplitudes. For more supersymmetric theories or friendlier theories, there's a substantial reduction in the graph, but there's still a greater redundancy than our beautiful symmetric representations. My hope is that this can be a springboard to a description that starts collapsing the redundancy, that it may be an avenue to recycle formal all-multiplicity tree-level insight into all-multiplicity loop-level insight. It should at least be a vehicle to get more color kinematic data at low loops in theories with less supersymmetry. And, of course, if you guys have non-planar integrands you want to jump up and down on, I am more than happy to help. And with that, I'll conclude.
You mentioned that the BCJ relations can sometimes also give relations between integrals. I was wondering if you could give an example.
Oh, I didn't say the BCJ relations could give... Well, I believe that at the heart of these integral relations is, of course, color kinematics. But what they did is they gave a form that could be easily integrated and compared such that... Okay, so I'll show you specifically. Maybe I can jump directly to it. So what we've observed is that at four loops and at three loops that that the subleading color contribution to the critical divergence, sorry, to the divergence in the critical dimension of the gauge theory is exactly the divergence of the supergravity theory at three and four loops. So there are relations at the integral level between gauge and gravity theory, at least in the UV, but yeah.
Further questions?
So you think there will be a fundamental learning from solving this five loop problem for the BCJ? I mean, there will be something new, concrete to...
Yes, absolutely. There will definitely be something new and concrete. And let me see if I... Okay. So we've known since we wrote down the planar amplitude for the five loop planar amplitude in 2006 or 7 of... Yeah, that something different was going to have to happen at five loops, and it's because of contributions from guys like this. Okay, so what we've learned from James and Johannes, right, is that right these guys for the gauge theory, right, are going to come in with loop momenta, right? So it's this dotted with this squared, right? Okay, so LA plus LB squared for each of these two propagators, right? This holds even on the maximal cut. So you can take the maximal cut of this, right? And you know the loop... You know what the loop dependence of just this topology is in the gauge theory. But on the maximal cut, the function squares to get the maximal cut of the gauge theory amplitude. Right? And that has worse loop momentum behavior than the worst behaved loop momenta in the gauge theory. Right? And so you could ask, if we knew this right away, even before we did three loops, and why go through all this work, this headache, you know, if we saw something, some glitch on a maximal cut of a five-loop guy. It's because maximal cuts are a very cruel thing to do to gravity. Gravity doesn't like talking about just one topology. Gravity likes when diagrams start to talk with each other. And as you release cut conditions and you look at the behavior, then things start looking very, very good. In fact, Radu and Lance and Zvi wrote a paper looking at what the implications to all loop order on cuts that touch every graph in every possible way, the implications of no triangle have. And they, on all these cuts that touch every graph in every possible way, with a very minimal set of on-shelf conditions, so all these graphs are allowed to talk to each other in all sorts of ways, then they found exactly the UV behavior of supergravity, of n equals 4. But of course that's not a proof, right? Because their cut conditions are imposed. But we know something happens. Something has to happen. But we don't know what happens. And so once we have five loops in our hand and we can probe it, then I think we really do have something to learn. Sorry, maybe that was a long-winded answer.
Other questions? So I just have a brief question.
Oh, sure.
Following your conjecture, is it assuming your conjecture is true, does that now mean that you are able to write down the, let's say, five loop amplitude in the form where you have double copy and then where you have the color kinematic form and then produce a conjectural supergravity integrand?
Oh, well, so the moment we have any supergravity integrand, we can check the heck out of it and it wouldn't be conjectural, right? So the barrier to going on to five loops with this is the tremendous redundancy in graphs, right? So it's you're talking about taking, I think, a 14-point tree down to for all the different way. So I don't have. Let me do three loops first. Let me do three loops first this way. Then I'll have something to say about higher loops. I think this is going to be useful more as a probe at lower loop order first as I start to get a hang of this. But it's pretty theory agnostic, which is nice. I mean, if you're going to be dealing with all these graphs, you might as well be talking about gritty theories, so yeah.
Okay, but if I understood correctly, if the conjectures work, although it may be systematically very difficult, in principle,
yes,
it's guaranteed
to
produce you something in color kinematic form.
Yeah. Or it would. So if for example, if you had so this pseudo inversion that happens as you invert the color ordered pre-integrands or color ordered tree level amplitudes, right? If that weren't to work, right, on a minimal set of cuts, then I think a loop level color kinematics would be in trouble. So this would be, I think, a sharp test of whether all loop order color kinematics is realizable. Yeah. Because it doesn't, by the way, it doesn't care about locality at all. I mean, when you're doing this sort of inversion, you get what you get so far. You land on non-look, so I showed these pretty representations, STA tree, you know, S squared TA tree, but what comes out is some incredibly non-local thing that you jump up and down with conservation momentum identities until it reduces to, right, because you're really inverting some, you know, non-trivial matrix full of all sorts of momentum invariants running around.
Okay, so before we thank JJ again, I just want to remind you that I think this time there really will be an announcement. So stay where you are. So first, let's thank JJ again.